Dennis Vivananda Goswami. And some of you know him from his travels around the country. For those who haven't met him yet, he's one of the really pioneers traveling the world, especially South America and North America. We were just talking about the library parties, a lot of the sets of books we see in our libraries. He was one of the early pioneers who got those books into a lot of these libraries. We're talking about Iowa City and Kansas, Colorado. And he's presently traveling, teaching wonderful science of Bhakti Yoga, and side by side also working on some writing projects. Association with us for the week or longer.
So, while I was waiting for the program to start, based on the demonstration of sweater folding, I was reading some pages on the bulletin board of the philosophy department, and I've always had sort of an interest in philosophy, despite modern philosophy. And so, it was an interview, the chairman of the department was interviewing another scholar who had just published a book on showing the transition from medieval philosophy to early modern philosophy. So there were a few points in the interview that I thought were sort of interesting to us, considering our concerns. First, the chairman, it was interesting, he said that as a chairman, every year he has to address the parents of their graduating students, and it's always a problem, or has been a problem for him, because many parents are concerned about their children majoring in philosophy, like, what are you going to do for a living? And it's, you know, it's not quite as bad as joining the Hare Krishna movement, but there is concern. There, you know, basically, if you get a philosophy degree, you sit around and wait for someone to die, and then you compete with 1,000 other people to get a job. So, in fact, philosophy departments now advertise that their degree is good for getting into other schools, like law schools or whatever. And then he said, the chairman said that rather than say what philosophy prepares you for, he's going to talk about what it doesn't prepare you for. And what it doesn't prepare you for is mental tranquility. Mental tranquility. And the reason it doesn't is because philosophers have this relentless drive to discover fallacies and inconsistencies and illogical claims and so on and so forth. And then he said what they often say, this is kind of like the standard rap song for philosophy professors, and that is that we raise difficult questions about God and the soul. For example, is there really a soul that survives the death of the body? Or is it logically consistent to say that there is a God who at the same time is all-powerful and moral, given the state of the world? I mean, that's sort of a very old thing about the problem of evil in the world. But in any case, so what he said that was very typical is that it's difficult to answer these questions. Come on in.
Excuse me.
Yeah, we got a seat right back there behind your face. So, I remember when I was at, I did a little bit of my, or part of my undergrad, actually more than a little bit, part of my undergraduate work at UCLA, and I took one philosophy course in which the professor said at the very beginning, we're going to ask very interesting questions about morality and things like that. So and he said, we won't answer the questions, we won't be able to answer the questions, but we hope to, we won't be able to give the answers, but we hope to refine the questions. And so, and also this scholar kind of mentioned that we, you know, you're not, it's very likely you're not going to find answers to these questions, but we have to keep trying. And so the point I want to make here is that we, of course, come from a very different perspective. And so this person is, I mean, mean, the point of the philosophy chairman here was that if you are, in a sense, intellectually honest, if you are intellectually honest and if you know how to do philosophy, then you probably won't have mental tranquility because you'll see the difficulty of the questions and the answers themselves have problems and so on and so forth. So I'd like to discuss a sense in which I feel he's right and a sense in which I feel he's wrong. The sense in which he's right, and I'll start out being nice. If you've ever heard of people like Hegel, people nowadays, you've heard of Hegel, Professor Hegel, and then of course his brightest and most dangerous student, Karl Marx. So Hegel is famous for saying that history moves dialectically. There's a type of dialectic, which is sort of the engine of history. It's what drives civilization on or up or down, wherever it's going. So the dialectic basically is that there is a thesis, you probably know this, a thesis, which just means the way things are right now, the status quo. There's the thesis, and then something opposes that thesis. Well, to give an example, I was born at a time when nationalism was sort of nationalism was just the natural, moral, proper way that human beings should politically organize themselves. Because, I mean, there are smaller and larger levels of political organization. I mean, you can have city-states, or you can just have, I guess, state-states, like in Italy and Germany at a certain point, or you can have nation states, or you can have empires. So I was born at a time when the nation state, the fact that human beings organize themselves into political nations, that's what people should do, and if they have smaller levels of unification, like city states, there's something wrong with that. And if they try to go bigger, like empire, that's also obviously evil, as we've learned from innumerable Hollywood movies. So empire is evil. Although, I mean, no one stops to think that all the larger nations of the world are actually empires. I mean, the idea that America, you know, like the federal system of government was challenged in the Civil War. Of course, there was definitely a moral problem with the Confederate view, which in a sense was not directly related to slavery. It's just they just felt. But in any case, that's being challenged now. I don't want to go into the whole political thing, but nationalism is now being challenged by globalization. So I'm just using that as a simple example on a large scale, that I was born at a time when it was absolutely unquestioned that the proper way for people to organize themselves politically was a nation. Now with globalization, internationalism, in fact, from between our former president, and Obama, There's been a dramatic shift in presidential political philosophy from nationalism to internationalism, in a sense, which I think in some ways is healthy. So, but in any case, this internationalism is kind of a challenge to nationalism. The global economy, and as Marx pointed out, the growing level of international law, which is necessary because of the reality of international commerce and so on. And so, in that sense, internationalism is the antithesis of nationalism. It's a challenge to it, and eventually something else is going to emerge, like some reality by these two things coming together. And so, if you think, in a sense, if we are spiritual practitioners or considering a spiritual practice, whatever, I mean, no one really considers doing anything, whether it's going to school or dropping out of school or taking up a spiritual practice or doing something else. You don't really consider doing anything new unless somehow the status quo is not in and of itself perfect and complete and fully satisfying. Because like when you get up in the morning, if you were absolutely satisfied just lying in bed, you would never get out of bed. So in a sense, unless we take up a spiritual practice like Krishna consciousness, then on the one hand, there's the constant happiness of spiritual realization, of purification. It's like if you're sick, and you just feel really bad because your body's sick, and then you start to get better. It feels great because when the body is healthy, really healthy, you just feel good. You just feel good because your body's healthy. And so when your mind is healthy, you feel good. And so imagine when your soul is healthy. But on the other hand, there's this constant dialectic where this is where I am now. I'd like to be in a higher state of consciousness. I would like to be a better person. And so that creates a tension, which is a creative tension. Heraclitus, what do they say in Spanish? Heraclito. Heraclitus, the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, he's famous for saying that if you consider a bow, like bow and arrows, if you consider a strung bow, the reason that the cord, the string on the bow, can project the arrow is because of the tension between the two ends of the bow. And so if you have a bow in which there's, you know, the cord is just kind of like flat, there's no tension, you can't shoot an arrow. It's only because of that tension between the two the ends that there's some energy there that can be utilized. So in a sense, if you're not satisfied with where you are now, that can be very powerful. That can create a very powerful motivation to do better, to do more, to improve yourself, come to a higher state of consciousness and a higher state of behavior and so on. So in that sense, I would say that, again, talking about the philosophy chair here in Colorado, that there is a sense in which complete tranquility, or let's say premature tranquility, if you're absolutely satisfied with your life, even though you have a long way to go, you basically become inert, you know, spiritually inert, morally inert, even intellectually inert. You're just not going to move because you have no reason to, because there's no problem with the way things are now. So, on the other hand, you can go to the other extreme and you can become, you know, become too much anxiety. But a healthy amount of dissatisfaction with your situation now, well, it is healthy. That's what I mean to say. There's a certain amount of dissatisfaction which is healthy, which doesn't depress you and doesn't paralyze you or anything. It just motivates you to do great things in the world and with yourself. On the other hand, so that's the sense in which I would agree with the philosophy professor here. The sense in which I would not agree is that, and one thing that was lacking from his, I actually read two things. One was an interview with another scholar that I'll talk about later, another professor here. The other one was just, I think it was basically his remarks at commencement to the gathering they had for philosophy majors and their parents. You could, this is America, so we can talk about baseball. You know, to use a baseball example in Italy or something, people don't really get it. Or even in Brazil. But if you imagine a baseball, I mean, you could design a baseball field where there would never be a home run. You know, just put the fences like 700 feet back. And, you know, put the pitching mound maybe like, you know, 20 feet from home plate. And you're really never going to get a home run. And then you could just say, well, you know, that's just the nature of baseball. You just don't get home runs. But it's not the nature of baseball. It really just reflects the way you've set up the ground rules. So in the same way, what was lacking, I felt, from this professor's remarks on philosophy, and I'm not against him, I've never really met him, but what was obviously lacking to me was a certain level of self-awareness that you are not merely doing philosophy, but you are doing philosophy with certain ground rules. And the ground rules guarantee no home runs. In other words, no great discoveries of eternal truth. Because the fences are like 700 or 800 feet back, and the pitching mound is, you know, the pitcher's 20 feet from the batter and everything. And one strike, you're out. So I like to talk a little bit about that, because we make claims. Obviously, we traffic in absolute truth. You know, that's what we do. That's our product, the absolute truth. And so we are coming from a perspective which is very different from that of a typical academic philosophy department, even one that's a little pious, like this one doesn't seem to be the most pious department. But because the ground rules, how should I put it? When any group of people get together and talk to each other, whether it's the, let's say, the community, the international community of philosophy professors, or, you know, Hare Krishna program, or anything, just a group of people would get together and talk to each other about anything. Unless these people are just kind of a little, well, or very eccentric. People don't gather in order to engage in infinite regresses of proofs. In other words, if I... To give a simple example, actually I keep giving this example, I've got to come up with another one just for variety's sake, but you've never heard it, so I'll just do it again. Imagine if you were trying to prove to someone that, for people that listen to these lectures on TAFE, I'm starting to feel self-conscious, I'm punishing them with the same example. But let's say you're trying to prove the water boils 100 degrees Celsius, and someone doesn't believe you, so you get a stove, you get a pot, put some water in it, and put a thermometer in the pot. And then turn the fire on. And you say, look, it boiled at 100 degrees. And the person says, well, no. First of all, I don't believe that's real water. I don't believe that's pure water. I think you put some agent, chemical agent in the water, make it boil at a different temperature, higher or lower. And I don't believe that's real mercury in the thermometer. So you have to test the water, you have to test the mercury. But then you have to test the water testing chemicals, you have to test the mercury testing chemicals, and you have to test the chemicals that test... the chemicals that test them. So, at a certain point, in any argument, and this is what I'm telling you now is sort of a standard feature of philosophy, people know this. You, and Aristotle pointed this out actually thousands of years ago, you can be pushed into an infinite regress of proofs. And if you're pushed, in fact, Aristotle gives the example of an army that's being pushed back and it's kind of like on the run, and they can never. At a certain point, you have to stop and take a stand. So, to get out of an infinite regress of proofs, you have to take a stand. What does that mean? It means that you, well, they're different. I think the most common way, and I think ultimately the most reasonable, is you have to declare, and this is what we find also Lord Chaitanya doing, actually giving the same argument, Chaitanya Charitamrita. You have to declare that there is a fact, there's a significant fact in the world which is self-evident. In other words, it proves itself. And so, as I say, you can't hold a candle to the sun. There's nothing which illumines the sun illumines itself. And so, if there is a fact, if there's a significant fact in the world which is self-evident, there's no need to bring in another proof because it proves itself. And so self-evident facts are the starting points, in a sense, for philosophy. And so when you get a community, which is the community, international community of philosophy professors, who basically talk to themselves because very few other people are listening at this point in history, and that's a whole other story, like how academic philosophy kind of self-destructed, and there's a story to that. But, there was a time when philosophers in Western civilization were rock stars. And now, the philosophy chair has to try to pacify the parents who are really alarmed their students are taking such an impractical thing as philosophy. Like, why would any reasonable person want to do that? So the fortunes of academic philosophy have dramatically changed, and they kind of, it's a self-inflicted wound. But in any case, well, I'll just tell you so you won't leave me in suspense. What they did is in 1920, it's kind of like Argentina attacking England over the Falkland Islands. Decades ago, and Argentina lost. So it's like if you attack someone that's stronger than you, you're in trouble. And that's basically what philosophy did. In around 1920, or in the 1920s, they had a group of prominent philosophers that met in Vienna. They called it the Circle of Vienna, and they formally declared war, in a sense, on basically on spiritual things. God, the soul, that stuff. And they were sort of wannabe scientists because there was a time when philosophers ruled society, I mean intellectually. That's why if you get a degree in biology, it's called a doctor of philosophy, a PhD. The D in PhD is, no, the P, I'm okay. It's not age related. The P in PhD stands for philosophy. So I'm sure you can get a PhD in 100, or however 70 or whatever the number is here, in dozens and dozens of different fields, and your degree is a doctor of philosophy. And the reason is because there was a time when philosophy was sort of an umbrella term, so that if you, let's say, did what we now call biology or botany, that was called natural philosophy. Or if you did, let's say, what we now call psychology, or something in that general area, wasn't the same as now, it was philosophy of the mind. So there was a time when philosophy was king. Then science took over. And of course, there are stories behind all these things, and it goes back to people like Martin Luther, and his repudiation of the new sciences, and therefore they went it alone and eventually took over. So when philosophy was dramatically taking over, as you could say that they were the new kings of objectivity. Because, of course, universities preserved intellectual traditions like ancient philosophers and just all kinds of historical things. But ultimately, apart from sort of being learned in the traditions of the world, like, for example, learning a language which doesn't really have any geopolitical significance, but we should preserve that language. Apart from that, apart from purely intellectual interest, perhaps the most important function of the learned people of a society is that, at least the ones who are recognized as the leading thinkers of a society, is that they sort of, control the gates to objectivity. They declare what is objective and what is not objective. And so anything which doesn't get passed by them...
I guess it's fine.
No problem. So that at the end, you can just stay and watch the movie again. Go play again. And I remember the point you came in. Sorry, it's not in 3D, by the way. So, it's like for example, there has been this sort of demeaning bifurcation of knowledge, in the sense that science, and this is their take on it. Science deals with objective things, whereas religion deals with subjective things. So, if you're in the field of theology or religion, or even if you're in the field of, say, literary theory, basically you're just in a realm of opinions. And if you know Plato, that's a lower realm. I mean, the realm of opinions is much lower than the realm of objective truth. So, around the 1920s, a lot of the leading philosophers wanted to be scientific. They wanted to be scientific. And you can see the psychology among the oppressed. Like sometimes when people are oppressed, some of the oppressed people want to be like their oppressors, because that's how you sort of become respectable and everything, escape your oppression, is that you become your oppressor, you become like the oppressor. And that's a very well-known oppression psychology. So, among certain people, so the philosophers, they declared war to metaphysics, because things like the soul and God are not scientific, for obvious reasons, because they're metaphysics, they're beyond the physical world, they're higher things that you can't get at by physical testing, because they're not physical realities. I mean, just so you put this in perspective, among the things which are metaphysical and non-metaphysical are things like justice. I mean, produce a justice. What color is justice? How much does it weigh? What is the texture of justice? Or for that matter, if you want to be technical, yesterday. Or to take something really interesting, because you can't empirically prove yesterday because it doesn't exist. But perhaps the most important, or the most one that's very interesting for me, is that we have a political system in America which we kind of tried to force on everyone else. You might call it a secular democracy. I saw this great bumper sticker in Athens, Ohio. It said, if you're not nice to America, we'll bring democracy to your country. So anyway, what's very interesting is that there's this huge contradiction which no one notices, because thinking is sort of 19th century. But the contradiction is that secular democracy, equality. Obviously, the basic assumption of democracy is equality. If we're not equal, why give everyone a vote? Why not just let the people who are more valuable vote, who have more intrinsic worth? So the underlying assumption of democracy is equality. The problem is, equality is a religious assumption. You absolutely cannot prove equality scientifically. How are you going to do it? How are you going to scientifically prove that everyone is equal? I mean, it's absurd. It's a complete absurdity. At the University of Colorado, I'm sure they have entrance requirements. Right? So, I mean, we're not intellectually equal, we're not artistically equal, we're not athletically equal. We're not physically equal in terms of our strength. We're not equal in our, let's say, what do they call it, emotional IQ, social skills, administrative acumen. And the idea that, to give a little background to this, why am I doing all this tonight? I guess I'm trying to lay out something, an argument or a philosophy, which ultimately allows us, those of us who advocate Krishna, to, get into the intellectual octagon, and we don't have to tap out. I mean, you can really present Krishna consciousness intelligently. So, very quickly, the background of this is that, and I'll get back to the attack on religion, the attack on metaphysics. Very basically, for many, many, many centuries in Europe, and certainly in India, and everywhere in the world until the Industrial Revolution, people have this, at least the leaders of society, have a strong conviction that whatever social level you are born at, that's where God put you. So if you were born a peasant and you have aspirations to be something better, you're offending God. You're ignoring and repudiating God's plan for you. And of course, it's interesting that in Europe and in America too, they talk about the Indian hereditary caste system, which really is being decimated by, well, modernization. But Europe, I mean, for centuries and centuries had a hereditary caste system. In fact, everyone in America still gets very excited when British royalty comes over here, and that's a hereditary caste system. So, but in any case, so with the Industrial Revolution and with the French Revolution, just the whole dramatic transformation of Western society, it went from one extreme to the other. This is the same dialectic. In other words, it never stops in the middle, because that would be too intelligent. So it goes from one extreme to the other, and then it has to eventually, stop in the middle. So one extreme was that your birth, the social level of your birth, is God. God did that to you. So don't try to go higher, because you're messing with God. So your birth tells us everything. Your birth, all we need to know about you is what's your last name, and so on. What's your family? Now, it went to the other extreme, which is equally unscientific. It went to the other extreme, and that is that when you're born, I mean, never mind the social thing like your family and social status, but just your birth is nothing. Everyone is basically born exactly the same. The tabula rasa, blank slate. So that all of the differences between people, different levels of achievement, different, at every level, everything, all the differences between people are caused by society. So whenever you find an individual doing better than another, one group, whether it's ethnic, racial, or political, or just any kind of group, whenever one group of people does not achieve as much as another, it is because the group that didn't achieve as much is oppressed. And that's the only possible explanation, because everyone's the same. Science tells us something different. Science actually tells us that it's kind of like half and half, the middle ground, the middle path. That it certainly does affect us. Society certainly does affect us, and we also bring in certain stuff with us, which makes perfect sense if you understand karma and reincarnation. But anyway, so how did I get into that? The idea that society does everything to us. So getting back to this attack on metaphysics, equality, that's what I was saying. So with equality, The idea is that despite all the huge differences in performance and achievement of different individuals, none of that matters. We're still equal. And so my question would be, if all of science tells us we're not equal, never mind hot topics like, you know, like racial and ethnic groups, we don't have to talk about that. Let's just talk about individuals. As individuals, we're different. Never mind what race or ethnicity we're from. Just as individuals, we're different. And yet, we disregard all of science and declare that we're equal. So the simple question is, how do you know we're equal? How do you know we're equal? And you're going to have to give a metaphysical answer. You can say, I just know it, or if you don't see it, you're immoral, but that's not really a philosophical answer. You're just, hey. So, interestingly, the original answer to this question was given by Thomas Jefferson. Because when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, he was arguing for something that many people thought was absurd, namely equality. Of course, for him that was, you know, white males, but you could say he was going in the right direction, he just hadn't gotten there yet. So, but he gave an explicitly religious argument. No one knows that. The Declaration of Independence, the whole justification for American democracy is a religious argument. Namely, and getting back to the point of self-evident, remember the infinite regress of proofs which you escape by declaring something to be self-evident? That's exactly what Jefferson does. He was a very smart guy, and he was very well-read, and he knew exactly what he was talking about. He was using technical, philosophical terms. So Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That's why he begins like that. Or pretty soon he gets to that. Because when you declare something to be self-evident, it closes the door on any refutation. If something proves itself, if you don't get it, you just don't get it. And that's what Jefferson said to the King of England. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We don't have to prove that everybody's equal because it's self-evident. And what's the self-evident truth? That we are created equal. Not that we evolved equal, not that we are just born equal, we are created equal, endowed by a creator. Now, if that doesn't sound to you like religious language, you know, we're just not on the same planet. That is religious language. We hold these truths, it's a self-evident truth, which has the highest epistemological status in philosophy, a self-evident truth, that we are all created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. That just means no one can take them away. Because what God gave us, who's going to take it away? If God is giving this to us, or the Creator. Jefferson chose the word Creator. That's a whole other story why he didn't say God, why he said Creator. But anyway, he's reaching a wider intellectual audience by saying Creator. But it's a self-evident truth that we are created, that there's a creator. It's very interesting because now in America, the American judiciary, which often is not very bright, the American judiciary has declared that to say that, basically to repeat what's in the Declaration of Independence, should be banned from public schools. Because you should only teach evolution. In fact, in Colorado, here at this university, they have a department of evolutionary biology, just so that no one gets any smart ideas of doing something else in their biology department. But what's interesting is, let's say the biology department at Colorado is right. I'm not going to talk about evolution and intelligent design and all that. I will just say, though, that one of the most obvious, perhaps the most obvious case of silliness in the American judiciary is that intelligent design theory is a perennial philosophical position. The position of intelligent design was given by great philosophers like Plato many, many centuries before Jesus was born. And yet the American judiciary thinks it's a religious position because they don't know the history of philosophy. But in any case, let's say the biology department at the University of Colorado is right and Jefferson is wrong. And there is no creator, or we don't know if there's a creator. If there is, we couldn't really know it objectively, so we can't teach at a public university. And so then how are we equal? Jefferson gave the argument that we're equal because the creator endowed us with equal rights, and those rights are inalienable because it's like in that old marriage ceremony they used to have, you know, let no one separate two people that God has brought together. So God gave us this right, who can take it away? So let's say Jefferson is wrong, the University of Colorado biology department is right, and so why are we equal? Let's kick out the metaphysics, get rid of this, you know, this flaming metaphysics about creators and everything. And so now, how are we equal? I mean, just do it physically. Just do it empirically. Don't bring in metaphysics. Don't bring in creators. None of that. Just do it on material science. Do it on stuff from the biology department. How are we equal?
Same DNA.
But then how do you prove that people that have the same DNA should all get one vote? What about someone has the same DNA and it has the, let's say, the cognitive development of a five-year-old child? Should that person vote? Why not children? I mean, when you were 5 years old, you had the same DNA, but you couldn't vote. And if you say people with similar DNA should have equal rights, like, where does that come from?
Bananas
What's that?
The bananas have the same DNA as we do.
Yeah. See a banana hopping up to a So, it basically, it's obvious that there is no way to justify it. There is no way to demonstrate it. There is no way to show that there's anything objective about that assumption. And even, now I want to bring in one other point. We're talking about for those who came in late. And therefore won't get any refreshments. On the right around the corner here, there's philosophy department, and they have some stuff on the wall, you know, bulletin board. And the chairman of the philosophy department was interviewing another professor, who apparently is an authority in medieval philosophy, which is interesting because it's all kind of philosophical theology. Medieval philosophy and then early modern. And so he was saying that it's very interesting because there were all these philosophers in the 14th century who were almost giving Buddhist-type arguments. I mean, the basic, there are many, many different schools of Buddhism, but the one that's, let's say, philosophically more well-known, the Pratityasamutpada, the idea that there's only process, that you can't point to objects like that's a chair, that's a wall or something. They're just like processes, interdependent processes that we call objects. And basically, they gave that argument. These 14th century Christian philosophical theologians in the late Middle Ages gave that argument. But they said it doesn't apply to humans because humans have an eternal soul. So there is something about humans which is not changing, although their bodies are simply process, interdependent process. But not animals, because these philosophers didn't make the animal rights curve. And they thought that because animals have no soul, they're not persons, and of course, they absolutely have no rights. And there is no animal. So this is very Buddhist. This is Nagarjuna. If you know the great Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, this is like, oh my God, you know, we got to get you people together. So the animals, there is no animal. It's just like at every moment, almost, or every 10 minutes, whatever time frame you want to put on it. There's a different creature there because it's always in flux and there's no soul. Interestingly, these Christian medieval philosophers paved the way for atheism. I mean, they really are the pioneers of philosophical atheism because what are they saying about animals? What they're saying about animals is that a being, an existing thing, can be conscious, can have consciousness, including feelings. As we know, people become, where did all the science come from in America? You know, I lost my dog, Luigi. You know, Luigi is part of the family. You know, he's my best friend, or the cat, or whatever. I mean, if you just did like sort of like an anthropological study of missing dog and cat flyers on utility poles and trees, you would find that people have these very, or they think they have, these extremely developed, complex, emotional relationships with their pets. And so, it's actually the medieval Christian philosophers that said that you can have consciousness and feelings and all that without a soul. In other words, material bodies can produce consciousness. That's the basic argument of atheism. That you don't need a God, you don't need a soul. The material body can produce consciousness. That argument was introduced, of course, by the Christian theologians. But in any case, try to make some coherence of all these remarks that I'm making. Krishna consciousness is... I think we can reasonably argue that it's really the best philosophy. And not on dogmatic ground, not because this is a revelation, and if you don't believe the revelation, really bad things will happen to you, period. Like, whether or not you like the philosophy, it's just, it happens to be true, and if you don't believe it, you're really going to get it. It's not that. It's just philosophically. If you study, like we were talking about the philosophy department, what are, where you get a group of people together, what can we assume to be true? What is self-evident to us? And because different communities of people, at different levels of consciousness, have different types of agreement on self-evident starting points, it turns out that in the modern age, in academic philosophy departments and other academic departments, the level of consciousness is so whatever. I mean, it's not the highest. And therefore, what they can all agree on as a reasonable, self-evident starting point simply makes it impossible to really come up with any significant truth, spiritual truth. Like I said, you could design a baseball field where no one could ever hit a home run. It's very easy. Put all the outfield walls 700 or 800 feet back, put the pitcher 20 feet away from the batter, one strike, you're out, and you'll never get a home run. You play for 50 years and no one will ever hit a home run. And then you say, well, that's just nature of baseball. You just don't get home runs in baseball. And that's what these philosophers are doing. They've set the ground rules based on their own level of consciousness, based on their own assumptions about reality, and they've set the ground rules in such a way that no one can ever discover God or a soul. And that's the way they've set up the game. So, and yet our entire way of life is based on metaphysical assumptions which the philosophy department would have to say are not provable, like equality. All the science departments at the University of Colorado and the philosophy department, none of them can possibly come up with evidence that we are all equal in the relevant moral sense of the term, that we have equal rights. It's an unprovable and unproved assumption from the material point of view, yet it's the basis of our entire society. And so if it is actually a fact that we're equal, then there's Jefferson. Jefferson says it's a self-evident truth that we are created equal. It's a self-evident truth. And so if you reject Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, if you reject the original argument for democracy, what are you going to come up with? That you just know we're equal? I mean, you can come up with all kinds of poetic language like you find on greeting cards and all that. But apart from all that poetic language, how are you going to show we're equal? How are you going to justify things like justice? Why should I be nice to other people? Why should I be fair? Just because you feel I should? Do human rights turn out to be just an imposition of like law of the jungle, survival of the fittest? Typically, liberal people in this country say you shouldn't impose your moral views on others. Okay, then let's get rid of laws against rape, murder, theft, let's do away with equality. After all, those are all moral assumptions. So if we shouldn't impose our values, our moral values on others, how can we justify a law against murder? That's just your opinion that murder is bad. It's just your opinion that rape is bad. It's just your opinion that people are equal. So there's this huge incoherence in modern society, and people just kind of say things. They have no idea what they're saying. Yes, do you want
to? Would it be considered self-evident and not necessarily coming from God?
That what?
Would it be acceptable? I mean, someone says, oh, these things are self-evident that we're equal, but...
But what does that mean?
So it makes sense.
Well, if you say it is, it's like the children say, you know, it is. Why? Because it is. So Krishna consciousness extends the franchise to all creatures. In other words, there was a time when most people in the world felt that if someone belongs to a different race, they have no rights, at least not when they come into your land. And so you can exploit them, you can do anything you want with them, they're just a resource for you to do whatever you want with, kill, let them live, because they're different. Let me just finish this thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, or if someone has a different sexual orientation, or if someone, belongs to a different tribe, that basically people are the wrong gender. In other words, if people's bodies are different than your body, they have no rights. Only people who have bodies like your body have rights, and even then there are very limitations on that. So, what about people who have different bodies as a different species? As we know, there are porpoises, dolphins definitely have higher states of consciousness than many human beings that I've met. And so what about, I mean, there's this is actually even coming up now in America and Europe, and you're from in different places, like in different countries in Europe, like why don't certain conscious creatures have rights? And what if God is a self-evident fact when you're a certain, what do you do if God, let's say there really is a God, let's say there's Krishna, and that in a certain advanced state of consciousness, you can actually see that. And it's available, that realization is available to everyone, but you have to come to a certain level of consciousness. For example, let's say laws against laws against murder. I mean, there are people in America and every other country who are more or less by nature killers. I mean, it's not a large number, but there are people who really, even as children, they kind of, almost kill their playmates and everything, have to be restrained. There are people who are inclined to kill other people. There just are people like that.
People like me.
Yeah, I was just watching some news in a German television station, but I'm practicing German for a tour on the German. But, and I think a year ago, there was this horrible massacre. There was a German, prep school. And some student who had graduated came back and just started shooting everyone, mostly women. Somehow he had some history with women. And so I watched this whole documentary on the German TV station on the web. So what if the people who are killers say that you're just imposing your values? That from our level of consciousness, we think it's okay to kill. And from you claim that you're in a higher state of consciousness, and it's not okay to kill, but you're just imposing your values on. So what if you go to even a higher state of consciousness than, let's say, the average American? What if other things become clear at higher states of consciousness? So it gets into all kinds of issues that... And every law in the books is the imposition of a value. I mean, traffic light is imposing a value. Because it's security versus freedom. No traffic light, more freedom. Traffic light, less freedom, but more security. You put up a traffic light, you're imposing a value, a moral value. You're saying, security over freedom. Those are values. Yes?
Oh, I was just going to say something earlier about how far we've come in terms of recognizing people of other races. As even, I read something yesterday about some white people going to the reservation or something in the early 1900s or late 1800s and seeing a little, baby Indian and saying, oh, it's almost human, very lightly.
The interesting thing is that racism was basically universal up until, Hitler kind of ruined racism because he showed the consequences. But, if you go to Hawaii, for example, and read about the history, you don't have to go to Hawaii to read about the history of Hawaii, you look at the Native Americans. If you look at Africa, if you look at look at China and Japan, racism was universal. Human beings were racists. So that, for example, when the first Europeans sailed into a Japanese harbor hundreds of years ago, the Japanese thought they were freaks. just by their physiognomy. They had these straight noses, thin straight noses, and the Japanese really thought they were just like freaks, like monsters. And so I don't know of any place in the world where people were not racist. And racism was kind of seen, it's like, for example, nowadays, familyism. I mean, most people nowadays have a special allegiance to their own family and feel that, you know, somehow my family, that's where my loyalty is, and my family's more important than other families. And yet that is, you know, sort of biological discrimination. And just as now it is considered to be perfectly natural to favor your family over others because of a bodily connection, racism was considered to be exactly as natural. That a race is a family. It's a racial family. And therefore, whether it's in, you know, all kinds of interracial violence in Africa, because there were, you know, many, many different sub-races and different groups and everything. And everywhere in the world, I don't know of anywhere in the world where people were not racist. I've never heard of a place like that.
Were you right now?
Or historically?
No, I think right now, too.
Right now?
I think pretty much it seems like everybody's racist. In one way or another.
Yeah, it is. People do generalize. People do tend to generalize, and their generalizations are often not completely rational. But in any case, and speciesism. I mean, I hope that the time will come when it will be considered just as barbaric that you can kill a creature just because that creature is a different species, as barbaric as killing, let's say, someone because that person is a different race, or ethnicity, or tribe. But somehow, I mean, that's the challenge for those of us who accept Krishna consciousness. The real challenge is how to bring this knowledge, not merely privately, because, of course, we're doing that, we're trying, we're holding programs, but how do you change society? I grew up in an age when that was a big thing. I went to Berkeley in the late 60s, and so I guess I sort of have it in my blood somehow, this idea of improving, changing the world. And so how do you bring about a spiritual transformation of society in a culture which is sort of incoherent about certain basic things, like the fact that without a creator, we're really not equal. I mean, what, or without a soul? Without a soul or creator, in what sense are we equal? Or the basis of all, even the basis of, let's say, moral impositions like you can't kill. I mean, that's what about kills in the Bible. And so laws against murder are cases of imposing values on other people. Laws against rape, laws against theft. So how do we meet certain so-called intellectual objections in the academy? The modern academy has been sort of like the champion of materializing society. I find that very ironic because, you know, typically liberal academic types will poo-poo all this consumerism and people are so superficial and stuff like that. But they're the ones who taught for decades that all spiritual ideas are just your opinion, private, personal views, which have no objective status. They're the ones that dedicated themselves for decades to materializing human thought, thinking that, you know, get rid of God, get rid of the soul, and everyone will just naturally gravitate toward liberal humanism. But they didn't. They gravitated, or they went like, they stampeded to just sort of just shameless consumerism. And all the traditional restraints on selfishness, on vanity. If you look at history, the traditional restraints on selfishness, vanity, were spiritual. And it's the academy that blew all that up, ridiculed it. And now they're unhappy because of consumerism. So in a sense, that's the challenge before us, not merely to make spiritual advancement ourselves, but how do we, I mean, because if you accept the challenge in your life that I have to try to change the world, then suddenly you get to star in a blockbuster movie. You know, like the Avatar that just came out. Actually, the producer of the Avatar, John Lando, who's a good friend of a good friend of mine, admitted that it was because of Krishna that they made the Avatars blue. That's where the blue came from. And a lot of other things they got, actually, from the I mean, interconnectedness of all life. That's ultimately why the good guys won in the Avatar movie, because the Avatar prayed to the deity who mobilized all creatures, because all creatures are interconnected. And of course, that comes also from Vedic culture. So, I mean, that's a lot more fun. Why not star in your own blockbuster movie? Why not? And it doesn't mean, like, you can never have a family, you can never have a job. It just means that whatever you do, whatever your path is, however you're going to work through your human condition by having a particular career or whatever, also really have a mission in life to change the world, to save the world, to bring knowledge to the world. Basically, what has happened historically, maybe I'll end with this little point, is that if you look at societies generally end up with a moral and spiritual consensus. In other words, if you look at different societies, different periods in history, and different geographic locations, there tends to be a type of consensus on what is good and bad, on where we come from, on what divine power is, and so on. And so in Europe, or the Western civilization, there was for centuries a consensus, or, you know, coerced or voluntary to some extent, which was sort of Christendom, the kingdom of Christ on earth. And that was the metaphysical consensus. And that, of course, as we know, has completely broken down as a consensus. There are many devout Christians still in the world. And fortunately, we're not, you know, two-thirds of Christians in America, according to the latest surveys, believe you can go to heaven through other religions, which means we're not back in the Middle Ages. So, but there is no consensus. And so really the only thing people can agree on is the ground rules for selfish pursuit. In other words, it's sort of like the underlying assumption is everyone is selfish, everyone wants to get whatever they can for themselves and their family, and there have to be ground rules. So the purpose of society and government is not to elevate people, not to enlighten them, not to foster higher consciousness, but simply to referee the animals, as everyone tries to get their snout in the trough. The purpose of government and law is just to kind of, you know, be the referee. So everyone, you know, follows the same rules as they pig out. And government has been reduced to that. Government has really been reduced to that by all kinds of arguments given in places like the Academy and other places. So the issue is, without giving up all kinds of human rights and without giving up the diversity and freedom that we all value, how do we at the same time, within this very challenging framework of sort of extreme metaphysical relativism, within this very challenging historical framework, how do we actually reconstruct a spiritually based society that won't self-destruct? And that seems to me a great challenge. That's a great movie, which we all get to star in our own ways. Yes.
You mentioned at one point that the Academy, as they like to do, is not provide answers, but to just raise questions.
Well, they tend to attack answers which smack of wisdom.
I actually have one professor that, starting out, said the same thing. He said, the best kind of education is that which raises the questions. And then you mentioned that this one professor said something about fine-tuning. What we're going to do is fine-tune the questions.
Yeah.
My question right now is that, is there any benefit to that? Can there be any ultimate benefit?
Let me give you an example. In the Bhagavatam, the third canto, there are 12 cantos in the Bhagavatam. So in the third canto, there is a long discussion that goes for many chapters on what is called Samkhya, which literally means for like the enumeration of the fundamental principles of reality. And it's a particular philosophical approach, which, by the way, is the philosophical basis of the yoga tradition. The two most famous books on yoga, ancient books, are of course, Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali, and both those books assume a lot of the principles of Samkhya philosophy, which is just a way of analyzing fundamental principles of reality. And so, in the description of buddhi, which means intelligence, buddha is, you know, the masculine name, and then the feminine noun, buddhi, means the intelligence itself, the awakened state itself. And so the first, in that description of the Bhagavatam, the first symptom of buddhi, the first symptom of higher intelligence is saṃśaya, which in Sanskrit means doubt. So, but it's like if a recipe calls for, let's say, salt, and you put in, let's say, a pound of salt into a little pot of soup. So this is not an extremist skepticism. It's just reasonable doubt. So, because that's why I'm doing what I'm doing right now, is because I doubted the career that, you know, people around me when I was a kid told me I should pursue. And I had doubts about material life and I ended up doing what I'm doing. So here's one point. Well, you can discover a lot of things just by studying common language. So in our civilization, there is a very, very common term, which is blind faith. And, you know, in a university, probably the worst sin you could commit, let's say, well, maybe after serial killing, the worst sin you could commit is the worst intellectual sin you can commit is blind faith, especially of a religious type. And these scholars don't actually realize the blind faith they have in a particular intellectual system. They don't think so much about that. But where does the balancing term blind doubt? The term blind doubt is not a common term in our culture. And yet, let's take algebra. If you believe something which is not true in algebra, or you doubt something which is true, you're equally wrong. There's no sense in which you're better off by doubting something that's true. Let's say you're taking a test and you have a hunch that the answer is B, but you doubt it, and so you don't mark B, and it was B. Or let's say you're taking a test and you think it's E, but it's not E. So doubting the truth is just as wrong as believing the untruth. Yet, our society is, I don't want to say more than tilted, it's just like it's way over on the side where in the academy, doubt is respectable even if it's not rational. In an academic environment, if you say, yeah, I don't believe in these religions, you don't have to explain why you don't believe them. Doubt is intellectually respectable without good reasons. Whereas belief is not intellectually respectable, often even with good reasons. And yet, epistemologically, just talking about the nature of knowledge, but, you know, doubt is, there's no difference. So, now, to give an example of the application of this silliness. If I say I'm teaching a course, like last year I taught at the University of Florida. So let's say I'm teaching a course in Greek mythology. I don't teach that, so it's kind of get a little distance here. If I'm teaching a course in Greek mythology in a public university, I'm free to say, for example, that, come on, there is no weather god named Zeus who has a wife named Hera. And that's not why it rains. And we know that's not why it rains. We need to talk about meteorology. That's perfectly okay. But if I go into the same class in a public university and say, actually, do you know why it rained? Because there really is a Zeus. That's why it rains, because Zeus makes it rain. Now, at first people just think like, huh, that's funny. But if they see I'm serious, I really mean it, of course, obviously I'll be thrown out immediately. So, going back to the point about negative and positive claims, in algebra, let's say in algebra, if some kid writes an equation, and the teacher says that equation is correct or incorrect, in both cases, the teacher is claiming to know algebra. It requires exactly the same knowledge to mark an answer right or wrong. In other words, either you know it or you don't know it. If you know it, then you know this is the wrong answer, that's the right answer. It requires exactly the same knowledge to mark answers right or wrong. So to say that Zeus is the god of rain, or to say Zeus is not the god of rain, requires exactly the same religious knowledge. So to deny that Zeus is the god of rain is no less a religious claim than to affirm that he is the god of rain. In other words, in public universities, you can preach your head off all your religious views as long as they're negative. You can make unlimited negative religious claims in public university. But God help you if you make a positive claim. And yet epistemologically, the negative and positive claim are equally religious. So you can preach religion in a public university if it's negative. I find that very interesting. And so that's what's going on right now. That's what's going on. That's the world we live in right now. So doubt is good if it's rational. For example, based on my experiences in life, it would be grossly irrational of me not to serve Krishna, not to, you know, peddle this product. It would be grossly irrational of me not to do what I'm doing. I'm sorry, you had a question?
Oh, I was going to say that. You know, you said what's the next thing or whatever. And I think like the biggest overlooked subject is love. Because that's the next big, huge frontier. Just because it seems like everybody sort of missed the boat. Yet, like, the boat is right now. And I think it's like, that's the same thing Krishna
yeah.
is all about. And
yeah.
He was just explaining, you know, maybe just a take on it, but you know, when you sing the song Hare Krishna, it's all like this love energy coming through, and that's so like the perspective that you give on like the intellectualism and the college is that's that paradigm, that's that energetic. So we could talk circles for centuries.
The problem is that a lot of people are not willing to open their hearts,
sure,
to a loving experience because they have intellectual problems.
But that's the paradigm. So that's the energetics. So once you're in it, you can't see out of it.
There is a loving spiritual intellectualism.
Sure, but is it just an intellectualism?
It's not. No, it's spiritualism or it's love of God.
Sure.
But people have different. For some people, as you said. Let's say the philosophical issues are just irrelevant. Like, I know what I want. I want to love, or I want to love God, or I want to love other souls. And so it's not a problem for them. Therefore, they don't need explanations. But there are many people. In fact, I would say that... sorry, because I'm doing it again. You see, I'm chronic. Sociologically speaking, if what a society needs to really go toward virtue... and love, because love is also virtuous. In other words, love means that I have all kinds of selfish desires within me, but I'm not going to act on all of them. I'm not going to attack that other person. I'm not going to even verbally attack that other person. I'm going to care about all creatures.
Is that intellectual? Is that real love?
I think that we have different parts of us. We have an intellectual part. We have an emotional part. We have a physical part. And different souls, incarnated in different bodies, are sometimes, you could say they place greater or lesser value on different aspects of their existence.
Right, and we could just run the wheel of samsara around and around and around. But when we're in Krishna consciousness,
yes,
it's totally completely
different. It is, but what we're trying to do is out of love, we're trying to bring more people along because we need the fact that right now in America there is this divorce, there is this like the and rather than having a whole society which could be loving or spiritual, in fact we have the civil war going on in many levels between cultural war.
Sure, it's just going to run around and get busy.
And so the fact that in the universities where nowadays, you know, a huge number of people go, they pass through there. They hear all kinds of materialism. I think that's one of the reasons why the world's in the state that it's in. And so, if someone is loving and doesn't need philosophy, then, you know, good for them. But the point is, a lot of people do care about what ultimately is reasonable and logical, and I think that is not merely a lack of love. You can be intellectual because of love. Because It's like, for example, there's if you're a doctor and you say, I only do heart injuries, not brain injuries. The problem is that, oh, sure, if you want to be a cardiologist, but there are brain injuries that have to be treated. And I think that our society has a very serious brain injury. Well, and it has to be treated.
I don't think it does. It's perfect. It's perfectly just weird in its own weird.
Well, the world was already perfect. You wouldn't have to talk about love, and I wouldn't have to do what I'm doing. I mean, the fact is that the world's in a very precarious situation. There's a lot of very bad things going on. It's not perfect, for example, that huge numbers of people are being exploited and even killed. That's not perfect. And I think one of the reasons that's going on is because of ignorance, because of lack of knowledge. People, and you can tell people to love, but to me, like some people will respond to that. You can say that we should love, and some people will understand you and respond to it. Other people won't.
That's perfect disintegrity.
That's perfect what?
Disintegrity.
I don't think it's perfect. I'll grant you this. If we accept that God has created the world to gradually enlighten souls, then you can say everything that is happening to us is ultimately for our good. Mm-hmm. However, if I see a person, let's say, attacking a child, and I say, that's perfect. No, it's not perfect, and therefore I'm going to intervene if I can. In fact, if not to love is perfect...
Just with that philosophy?
No, but what I'm saying is, if so many people in the world today are not, let's say, loving up to the standard we'd like, yeah, then that's perfect. If it's perfect not to love, then there's no value in loving.
I mean, this is like the trip of it, because I can me-promorphize the whole thing.
Like, you can what?
I can me-promorphize it. Like, or I can take him or her, whatever her name is, Sally. Sally promorphize the world. I can project what is perfect. But I'm really talking about a different kind of perfect here.
Yeah, what kind of perfect are you talking about?
I'm just talking about, like, perfect manifestation. You know, if you focus on anger, you're going to get perfect anger.
If someone, let's say, is harming an innocent person, I don't think that's perfect. I think that's actually very imperfect.
Yeah, and then with that philosophy, then it's like everybody has to really step it up.
Everybody has to really care about other people. In other words, you cannot love. If you really thought everything was perfect, then your love would not compel you or even encourage you to do anything to help anyone.
That could be just your pomorphized version of it.
No, I think I'm just using English words in their normal sense.
Right, and then this could be like the spiritual conversation versus the academic.
I think there is a lot of good to do in the world, and like a doctor, if a doctor tells every patient, hey, you're perfect. Yeah, but I've got this gaping hole. No, you're perfect. So the point is that in this world, there are real problems. And if we love people, we want to see them happy and free from those problems. So a doctor who thinks every physical body is already perfect would not be very motivated to help people. In fact, bodies have problems. Souls have problems. So it just, I don't quite grasp the sense of perfect there.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a conversation is the epitome of your conversation tonight with everybody. It's because you could run me over loud language, and you could be like, oh, be quiet. Just wait one second.
But you're using English. You see, by the way, this is a very interesting thing that happens if you study the history of Indian philosophy. It's very interesting that there were different groups who argued that words can't really get the truth, like just words, 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 but they tended to publish more books than anyone else. And, I mean, you find this in certain Buddhist schools who sort of, were language bashers. And you found it in certain followers of Shankara who were language bashers, in the sense that language is only valid to show how silly the language of other people is. But so I can use words, but they can't use words. When they use words, they're being meaningless, but I can use words to refute them. That's exactly what they did. So language is valuable. For example, if there's a fire and innocent people are in danger, I can use language to save their lives. language can be used very effectively to express love. Language can be used to persuade people not to do bad things, to do good things. So language is not evil. Language is actually a wonderful thing when it's used properly.
Yeah, but it comes from Christian consciousness.
Yes. So there are people in the world, and I have to confess, I'm one of them. To me, it's very important to be reasonable. I want to get things right. I want to know exactly what am I doing, why am I doing it, and is this reasonable? And there are other people in the world who have similar concerns. And actually, Prabhupada, the first letter Prabhupada wrote to me in 1969, when I was just a young guy, and I was in Berkeley, and I thought, I should just drop out of, you know, should I just drop out of Berkeley and just chant Hare Krishna? And Prabhupada wrote to me and said, stay in college. He said, I want you to be nicely educated so that you can present Krishna consciousness to similarly educated people. So there are people in the world who want to get things right. And the idea that you don't need philosophy, you just need to love. Because, frankly, that was a justification for the Inquisitions. I'm not saying that you're an inquisitor. I certainly don't think that. But what I'm saying, that the dangers of, you know, sort of like poo-pooing philosophy. Because they thought that, I mean, consider this. If you actually believe that anyone who accepts a false doctrine, then the supreme serial torturer, God, will torture that person forever just for slight theological mistakes. So if you believe that the nature of God is that he tortures people forever, it's a very long time, that God tortures people forever just because they, you know, got a few points wrong. Even if they love God and love their neighbors and love their families and they love everything, but still they'll be tortured forever. Therefore, if you kill that person, if you kill a false preacher, that is your love for the world. If you kill a false preacher, you are showing your love for the world because you are saving so many souls from eternal torture. It's just like, let's say someone comes into this university and they're just like shooting people, and you take that person down. Let's say you do not have a practical option to just disarm the person, to either shoot him or let him go on killing. Those are your two options. And so you shoot him. And so actually, there was a type of grisly, horrific logic to the Inquisitions, the witch burnings, all that. And even, for example, the first guy, I forget his name, I should remember it so I could. But the first guy during the reign of Henry VIII in England, the first guy who translated the Bible into English and published it was killed for that by the government. It's so interesting because Jesus, if you study the book of Acts and so on, Jesus clearly was preaching to peasants for the most part. You know, fishermen, tax collectors, that was very basic Rome. Social letter. And most of them were illiterate. Anyway, so he's preaching to very simple people. And then when they worked up this whole ecclesiastical hierarchy, if you just let the people hear what Jesus said, that was a capital offense. And this guy was killed. He actually fled England. He lived in Holland. And he thought he was safe, but then Henry VIII sent like these secret agents and they dragged him back and killed him. So, and his sin was that he published the Bible in English. And Henry VIII, who was, you know, my God. Anyway, he thought he was acting out of love of God. And so so people in the name of love have committed the most horrible atrocities. Therefore, clearly, we can't just say that if someone reports to us that they're acting out of love, we can't criticize that because, you know, they said they're acting out of love. And so as soon as we start to say, well, what does it really mean to love? You see, then we're back in this, what you call this runaround thing. We're back in this, you know, pit of philosophy. Because as soon as I say...
Yeah, maybe it should be clear. Because I do believe there's a line, it's like a piece of a pie, and like the wisdom falls through and down into...
As
philosophy and stuff. Yeah. You know, like you're saying. Yes. It's like life building on life. All the way up into full blossoming, the perpetual Krishna love, the real deal. And the real deal of Krishna goes right into that too. And it's always right now.
And the same Krishna that created our hearts created our brains. And so what I am trying to do, at least what I'm trying to do, is to use my God-given intelligence in his service. And actually Krishna, okay, here's the gotcha. In the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 12, Krishna says, there's a very beautiful paragraph, you could call it, a series of verses in chapter 12 of the Gita, where Krishna says, like, do this, if you can't do that. And so it's like whatever level you're on, you can still be included. And so Krishna, and so the highest level, Krishna says, is the best option is that he says, Mayiva mana atatsva, fix your mind in me. Any of you like grammar of the word samadhi is like yoga trance. He uses like, anyway, 2/3 of the word samadhi, adi, in the verbal imperative. Anyway, sorry. I'll try and let it happen again. My eva mana adatswa, fix your mind in me alone. And then he says, mayi buddhingi veshaya, and dedicate all of your intelligence, your analytic intelligence to me. He doesn't say, turn it off and just love. He says, dedicate it to me. Now the word buddhi, intelligence, as opposed to the word jnana, knowledge, in the Bhagavad Gita, if you look at the way the word is used in the text, it clearly means analytic intelligence. Analytic intelligence. In fact, Krishna calls the whole process buddhi yoga, the yoga of analytic intelligence. And so it leads to love. It should, if it's working. It has to lead to love. And it should lead to the point of the ultimate, you could say, simplification or unification of all knowledge, where all that really matters is that I'm a soul and I love Krishna, and I want other souls to love Krishna, I love other souls. And I mean, it does come to that. But the road to get there, the whole secret of bhakti yoga is whoever you are, whatever your, you know, whatever your qualities and faculties and nature and personality and propensities are, give it all to Krishna. Krishna doesn't say it's better just to be simple and emotional than it is to be intellectual. There's no better. There's no worse. What Krishna says is, yat karoshi, whatever you do, make that an offering to me. And so it's not whether you do philosophy or you just do more, you know, expressive emotional things. It's what's your motive. If you just find yourself born with an intellectual body, that's just what you've got. You don't just deny it. You engage it for Krishna. And you can engage it with love. With love and devotion, you can engage those propensities, and you can help other people who care about things like being rational. You can help other people to also come to Krishna. According to this, Krishna says in the Gita, Chatur Varnya Mahasrishna, that I have created the system of four varnas. Not hereditary, but, you know, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras. The soul system. So, the main problem as I see it, from a socio-historical perspective in America, is that we do not have, let's say, the intellectual class or the teaching class in America. Those people who are the most respected teachers, who occupy those positions as the thinkers and teachers, tend to be materialistic, at least in their presentation, even if they're closet spiritualists at home. Because at the present time in America, if you manifest any type of spiritual propensities, it can be very likely you will lose your job, you put your family at risk, your children. And I mean, I just read it. I did my graduate work at Harvard, so I get this magazine. Actually, it's amazing. If you want to get an unlimited amount of fundraising appeals, go to Harvard. Because it's amazing how tenacious they are trying to get money for you once you graduate. But anyway, so there's this. I just read this article the other day that they... what did I just say?
About losing your job.
Yeah, you lose your job. Yeah, they had an article by this guy who's, I forget, it's like the head of the American Association of University Professors or something like that. And he was saying how it's a mafia, basically. He didn't use that word because, you know, he has friends. But in other words, it's this very narrow-minded group of people that have certain political views and social views and have certain intellectual views. And if you don't agree with them or pretend to agree with them, you basically cannot, you will be thrown out. You cannot have a job. You cannot teach in most modern universities. And that dogma, that company line that you have to toe, that company line is very much materialistic. and in some ways sort of antagonistic towards serious spirituality. And so the lack in America of a head, a body without a head. You know, you can have the biggest heart in the world, but if you get decapitated, you're not going to have any feelings, at least in that body. So there's a sense in which modern society has been spiritually decapitated.
Yeah, in case you say something real quick.
Sure.
Okay. And then I was like, yeah, I'm talking to my new friend. And I'm like, yeah, I love, you know, I love, we fucking love. And he's very, like, intellectual. And he was the director of Amnesty International in Washington and head of Noetic Sciences as president. And does all this, like, great stuff. And he's like, yeah, the Obama administration, they're, like, kind of, like, they're running out of ideas. So they invited us and a lot of other people who wrote, a few other people who wrote books, like the God of Physics stuff. And I was like, yeah, you know, can you, like, relay love to them? And he was very roomy. I just think it's very interesting that, as you see, it's sort of not working.
True.
But we're in near materialistic plane.
Yeah, you're right.
So then the administration's looking for new ideas, and it feels like spiritual.
That would be very good. Obama, by the way, there seems to be serious evidence that when he was a young a teenager, he used to, some of his best friends were Hare Krishna devotees, and he used to always be associated with devotees, you know, Bhagavad Gita and eat prasad and stuff like that. So, you know, hopefully he'll get it. I mean, he needs to. I like Obama, he's a nice guy, but.
I mean, just showing, like, the edge of consciousness.
Yeah. I wish he hadn't taken his whole staff out for a big photo op, you know, to get hamburgers. Because, you know, he's supposed to be the environmental president as opposed to George W. Bush. And yet, you know, the United Nations has published a paper saying that the cattle industry worldwide produces more greenhouse gases than all the motorized vehicles in the world. And then Obama takes the staff out to get hamburgers. It's like, hello? So, I mean, you know, I like him. I think, you know, he's a nice guy, ultimately. But I agree with you. What you said, I think, is significant.
There isn't the same thing there. Like, hey, you want to come tell us about Hare Krishna at the White House?
Great. Yeah.
Great. We're learning.
Yeah. Hillary also, she got a Bhagavad Gita. She really liked it. And Bill, too. W never got one. So... Yeah. So, and really, you know, something that's like, I'll quote someone who I have a lot of problems with, but, you know, quote him here because he said the right thing. And that's Paul of Tarsus, you know, the St. Paul of Minnesota. And what Paul said is that because he was, you know, he was opening these little communities, he was traveling around sort of establishing little communities. And as inevitably happens, new communities, new converts, you know, they're fighting with each other and all kinds of local problems. So he's trying to stop them, you know, stop fighting each other and get out and preach. So in one letter he writes that, he says it's like the body. This is funny because this is right out of the Vedas. That society is like a body. Like in the Rig Veda, it said that the Brahmins are like the head and the Kshatriyas are like the arms to protect. And the Vaishyas are like the waist, you know, that nourishes the body, the stomach, and then the workers like the legs that moves the body and, you know, and holds the body up. So the Rig Veda, the oldest Sanskrit literature, gives this analogy or this metaphor, and you find it also in Paul in the New Testament, that society is just a body. So it's not that the heart should attack the head or the head should attack the heart or the fist should pound the legs. But it's, you see, that was Marx's model. Marx had this idea where there's sort of like this natural antagonism and conflict between social groups. And in God consciousness, in a God conscious society, it's just one body. So if there's a pain anywhere in my body, the head addresses it and wants to, you know, stop it. So if you take it that the society, like a living body, needs a brain, needs a heart, needs all these things, then it should all work together. So, anything else? If not, I guess we'll... What do we do next?
So, do you see any chance that the Academy is going to correct itself?
Yeah, I mean, it already started to get a little better because a lot of professors when they were young took LSD. I mean, to be honest, so... They're not so hard-nosed or hard other places. And also, it's interesting. Actually, one of, to give credit where credit's due, one development I think has been very positive is the entrance of much more women into the academy. And there's this whole postmodern thing. But a lot of people teach religion now, even like Asian religion. When they were young, they kind of dabbled in spirituality and ashrams and things like that, and that's how they got interested in it. And the women, not all of them, but many of them, have been the ones to say that kind of like this hard-nosed, agnostic thing. It's just kind of like a like male, anal thing. And so they're trying to bring, like, you know, more heart to the academy, like more openness and everything. So I think inevitably when men are just by themselves, they tend to be kind of like rude and, you know, all kinds of things happen. And so I think the presence of women in the academy, in some cases, has been a very positive development. And in general now, you know, because of the celebration of diversity and all that stuff, and so and also the, you know, the exaltation of indigenous cultures. And so some people are saying, well, wait a second, you know, with all this sort of like, you know, white male Eurocentric logic, you're bashing the sacred beliefs of indigenous peoples. And that's like a total no-no. So, and it's kind of been seen as almost like a type of intellectual colonialism. And so there are all kinds of countervailing trends. Still, you could hardly say there's a spiritual renaissance going on in the academy. But there are some rays of light. And yeah, there's a lot to be done, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, trying to save the planet is like one of those action movies where the planet's going to blow up and you got to get to Philadelphia and push a button so the planet doesn't blow up. So it's really interesting trying to give out this knowledge and trying to give out Krishna consciousness. And it's an inspiring life to sort of, again, satisfy our basic human needs so that we have a balanced life. But at the same time, really being inspired to try to save the world, change the world for the better, spiritualize the world in cooperation with other people. So we should try to do that in our life. It's a great life. So, Tat Sarvam Janaha, in Sanskrit that means, that's all, folks. So it does mean that. So perhaps we could have a little kirtan. Oh, I better save my voice because I'll end up without a voice. Yes.
I had one thing you said. You finished up on the body, and there's a really great poem. I think the guy's name is, but it's another Persian poet.
Rumi.
Like Rumi, but I think his name was like Saadi or something. Not Hafez, I learned the poem. It goes like, Bani Adam, it's in Persian, but Bani Adam ezay yek digaran, kedar ofarinesh, zay yek joharand. I forget the rest of it, but it means like the same thing. It's like the children of Adam or the human family are all members of one family. They're actually members of one body, yeah. They're part of each other. And when one of the members is in pain, then no one else can be at rest. Yeah, it's a universal, like, it's like many, it's like you look at the mythology, like, you know, Joseph Campbell, the different motifs have, like, appeared in different cultures that, like, don't seem to be related to each other, but these mythological motifs up here all over, so this is one of them, maybe.
Yeah, definitely.
The body.
The way Krishna explains this, by the way,
yeah,
is that it's in chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, 18.20-22.gita. Krishna, you know, the three modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. So Krishna's talking about jnana, knowledge, which is Greek gnosis, jnana. And so he says that if you were, let's say, in this lowest level of darkness, of this mode of ignorance, you'll just see the world in a certain way. And then as you come to the mode of passion, you see it differently. As you come to the mode of goodness, you see the unity of all life. And so in every religion, in every tradition, in every society, there have been people who were in goodness. There are people who are really, their predominant quality was goodness, and they all came to the same conclusion. You know, they may disagree about little details as that, but the idea that we're all one, that we're spiritually one, that all creatures somehow are valuable. If you look at the Sufi traditions, they got it. They understood the point. Because so anyone, when you come to goodness, you see that this unity of all life. And interestingly, in Passion, Krishna says, like, people think that men and women are just irreconcilably different, and people of different races are just different, like Americans and people in that country. And people who think that differences are fundamental, you know, we're just different, and that's the end of it. Krishna says it's in the mode of passion that you see the differences as fundamental. Mm. And in the mode of goodness, you see the differences are just a covering. And behind that covering, there is an eternal unity. So anywhere in the world, whether it's in a Sufi tradition or any other tradition, people that came to this sattva guna, this mode of goodness, they see the same reality. It's like, let's say, for example, if you can get 50 people from all different parts of the world who have, you know, let's say their eyes are healthy, they can see well, according to our normal understanding of what it means to be able to see properly.
Yeah.
And they're all going to agree, the sky is blue, the grass is green. So in the same way, among people who come to this quality of goodness, they'll see the same reality. They'll want to love God, they'll want to love other creatures, they'll see the oneness of all life.
Yeah, if they come to a certain level of consciousness, then they see these things.
Yeah.
They have these insights.
Because it's the same reality.
Yeah.
And then you get, let's say, like the rulers in Passion. That's why these Muslim rulers persecuted the Sufis. The Sufis were often persecuted. The reason is because the rulers were in Passion, at best. Some of them, I mean, there were exceptions like Akbar the Great and so on, but typically they were passionate, and therefore they thought, hey, what are you doing? You're nuts. Those are Hindus. We're Muslims. Whereas the Sufi sages would say, no, you know, we're all just souls. We're all just part of God. Or even other creatures are just souls. But when you sink down that level of passion, you just don't see it. You don't see the unity. You only see that we're different. And therefore, they persecuted the Sufis who were preaching unity. And that happened, you know. Again, there are some exceptions, but that often was the case. Pleasure. Con mucho gusto.
Que bien.
Que bien?
Que bien.
Oh, que bien.
Que bien. No hablo francés.
Ah.
Solo español.
Bueno, entonces vamos a darle en
español. Para que nadie entienda.
So, perhaps a little kirtan. Who's the designated singer? For the mother or father, whatever the child says to the parents, they come. And so if you sincerely cry out to God in any language, whatever you say, that is the name of God. If you're sincerely crying out to God, whatever language you use, it's just like help.
Allahu Akbar.